questions I talked to you about, but it's one that I want us to help understand the biblical perspective of serving the poor and some principles. Some of this is from sociology, but you're going to see how we weave this together for with Scripture. A privilege we have, the local hospital that we would call our welfare hospital. It's called Wishard there, Eskenazi. We're now training all of their employees. It'll take us 3 to 5 years to take them through this. The local police department is asking us to train their officers on this. And so we train it as we do, which is Scripture. So you'll see that. It's a real privilege. We've trained about 5,000 folks in churches there in the community, and we're continuing to broaden our step. So I'm going to take you through that. We're going to talk about poor in Scripture. There are hidden rules, the models, and how do we do effective ministry with those in poverty. So we talk about, and people say, what is poverty? And the greatest poverty is not knowing Jesus Christ. But sometimes it's a mindset. I can't do any better. This is my lot in life. I just got to deal with it. Sometimes there's, and this is a growing need, and I hope you hear this. This is an important thing. The things you do to work with those in poverty that are in generational poverty is dramatically different than situational poverty. And so many of you, fastest growing area of poverty in America is in the suburbs. The fastest growing area for hunger is in the rural communities. It's why the general church and the role that I have there has chosen your district to be one of the six that we focus on this next year, because you represent a great snapshot of what most of our churches look like. You have urban, and you have work in the urban, you have suburban, and you have rural. And so we have to develop strategies to deal with all of those. If we believe the primary cause of poverty is a lack of knowledge, we want to educate you. If we think it's oppression by powerful people, we'll work for social justice. If we think it's because of the personal sins of the poor, we just want to evangelize. And if we think it's a lack of material resources, we want to give you those resources. But here's the portrait of the compassion by Jesus. It's a picture of Christ with one hand nailed to the cross, then the other one holding a cup of cold water. That is the holistic view of compassion. And we can't just have one or the other. It's both. Amy Sherman is a friend. She of our ministry. She's working with one of our staff now to do some things. But she's one of the best writers right now in the theology of the church's role in compassion. If we look at how the Bible describes poverty alleviation, it's dependent on prayer. It includes evangelism. It's multifaceted and it's holistic. It recognizes the dignity of all people. It's highly relational and believes that the process is equally as important as the end result. Right. And if you're interested, I can send this slideshow to Kyle, and he will make it available to you.
That'd be great.
Here's an interesting thing. It says, this is from Deuteronomy 14. And so we're going to identify a very important understanding. At the end of every 3 years, bring all the tithes of that year's produce and store it in your towns, so that the Levites, who have no allotment or inheritance of their own, and the aliens, the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns may come and eat and be satisfied, and so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. Here are four categories that God tells us we're to care for. Levites, aliens, fatherless, and widows. Why did God choose those four categories? Exactly, and it's because of the law. The law forbid the Levites, when they went into the Holy Land, the Promised Land, they got nothing.
Yeah.
Only 11 tribes got property.
Yeah.
If you were an alien, if you were a foreigner, you could not own property. Mm-hmm. If you were a widow or an orphan, you could not own property. So they were subsistence farmers. Mm-hmm. You lived by what you produced. So they did not have the ability to provide for themselves. So God's law calls us to help those who cannot help themselves. Would you say that's a political reality today?
No.
I would tell you that the whole welfare model is a badly broken model. Because it says, oh, you don't have anything, I'll give it to you. And we entrap people into this. That's not the way of compassion for Christ. Unable to provide for themselves. In the book Toxic Charity, which is a great book, if you want to read a little bit more about that, it says, giving to those in need what they could be gaining from their own initiative may be the kindest way to destroy people. Yeah. Giving to someone that could provide for themselves what they need is possibly the best way to ruin. Mm-hmm. We should not be doing for folks who should be doing for themselves. Mm-hmm. But that's not political.
No.
Right. People living in generational poverty can view their situation much differently than do people who are not poor. This can mean that programs designed to serve the poor can have unintended negative consequences. Sometimes those consequences can be very devastating. I was working with some of our state office folks, and they come and bring out a new state program, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever it is, food stamps. And so how do they market it to the poor? We'll put an ad on a bus. That seems to be the most popular way in the inner city to market. And they'll say, well, everyone has a bus in their neighborhood. Yes. Let me read some life-changing things in God's eyes. Yeah. 50% of the neighbors who are English speakers in my neighborhood are illiterate in English. 70 to 80% of my neighbors who are Spanish speakers are illiterate in Spanish. So what's that play out? So let's think of the local elementary school. Now when your kids would never do this, but Jeremy'd come home from school when he was in elementary, and we'd open the backpack to look in to see what the note was that the teacher sent, and there's a science fair project growing in the bottom of his backpack. But we would take the note out and read it, right? Yeah. Because the only way we communicated with the teacher was in notes, right?
Yeah.
In Indiana, it's a requirement that every fourth grader get their eyes tested. And those who need glasses, then the school will provide them for them. Hmm. But the majority of kids who qualified never got the glasses. Why? Made sense for that middle-class person who designed the program, right?
Yeah.
And so we have worked with the schools and are still working with the superintendent to say, could you let us know and we'll communicate it? Hmm. You know, the urban Facebook is me talking to you.
Yeah.
Technology cannot replace human interaction. Being poor is hoping the toothache goes away on its own. Knowing your kids go to a friend's house but never have friends over to yours. Going to the restroom before you get in the school lunch line so your friends will go ahead of you and won't hear you say, I get free lunch when you get to the cashier. Our local high school, 23% of the freshman class will graduate. So process that. Now, all of them who graduate, so it's 100%. Every one of that senior class who graduates, 3.7% are college ready.
Wow.
It is devastating to these folks. It has a direct parallel to juvenile crime and all of that. But if you get a free lunch at our local high school, you have a nice bright blue card that you show as you go through. Any of you ever read the book, The Scarlet Letter? These kids live it out every day. Now, they all have IDs with barcodes, so we said to the school, what if we bought a reader for you? And let every kid just scan it, and no one has to know. So far, they haven't figured out how to make that happen. Being poor is coming back to the car with your children in the back seat, clutching that box of Raisin Bran you just bought, and trying to think of a way to make them understand that the box has to last. Being poor is a bathtub you have to empty into the toilet. Being poor is your kid's teacher assuming you don't have any books in your house. Is being $6 short on the electric bill and no way to close the gap. Being poor is people being surprised to discover that you're actually not stupid. Being poor is picking the 10-cent ramen noodles instead of that 12-cent because that's two extra packages for every dollar. What's the number one killer in most inner cities? Health issue? What is it?
It's
high blood pressure. Because everything we feed is canned, high in sodium, or things like ramen noodles. Carbs are a cheap way to fill you up. And so access to healthy food is a real challenge. Being poor is deciding it's all right to base a relationship on shelter.
Yeah.
Folks, we need to understand that as it relates to those who are being abused.
Yeah.
Being poor is having to depend on everyone. Being poor is sleeping in the park or in a burned out building. Being poor is having no say. Being poor is never being able to sleep until you're no longer tired. Being poor is people being surprised we're actually not lazy. Being poor is people who have never been poor wondering why you choose to be so. This is from the book When Helping Hurts, another good book to understand the biblical way for us to deal with the poor. It says, the way we act towards the poor often communicates, albeit unintentionally, that we are superior and that they are inferior. In the process, we hurt the poor and ourselves. And here's the clincher. This dynamic is likely to be particularly strong whenever middle to upper class North American Christians try to help the poor. Given these Christians' tendency towards a Western materialistic perspective of the nature of poverty. We define poverty by the lack of money. And so we think that's the solution. We think you have to have certain things. And I'm going to tell you, some of the richest people I know have nothing. You take the material definition of poverty plus God complexes of the non-poor. We're the answer, right? Plus the inferiority complex that the poor already have, and it equals harm to both of us. We're the cavalry. We're what the city needs, right? When a youth group will come to our neighborhood, one of the things, or even our summer interns or whatever, I'll say to them, first of all, you didn't bring God in your suitcase.
Amen.
He was already here. And you're going to leave, but he doesn't. So this week is as much about you drawing closer to him as it is to you reflecting Christ to our neighbors. What my neighbors need is Jesus Christ, not you. So reflect him. The interesting thing is that works in the suburbs too. There are three ways for us to respond: relief, rehab, and development. This is really big and very tangible for us as we think of disasters. You probably didn't, you may have heard this week that there was a tornado that went through Oklahoma, right? Do you know the Nazarene church that was hit 2 years ago got hit and just and messed up again? There and more. I was talking to Jim Cooper and I'm suggesting he move the church. if the only answer for us is to send relief supplies to that church, we get nowhere, right?
Yeah.
If we're sending bottled water and tarps, then we'll have to send more bottled water and tarps. We need to do other things, right? It is in people's lives as well. So we're going to look at these three things: relief, rehab, and development. Relief work occurs during and immediately following an emergency, and it includes not only life-saving interventions, but also the alleviation of suffering. Pastor Kyle is having a bad week, and he runs out of food for his family. Relief is me giving him a bag of groceries. If nothing changes, what's he need next week? Bag of groceries. And then if it's the next week. And so now, all of a sudden, what have I done? I forced Pastor Kyle to be dependent on me. And I'm not doing anything to help him provide for himself. Rehab follows and overlaps with the relief phase. Rehabilitative work increases the capacity of a local community, enabling them to better respond to future crises. It seeks to promote projects that restore services or livelihoods to a pre-existing or improved level. So I'm going to get Pastor Kyle GED training. I'm going to help him work on job skills. Because it's overlap. He needs food, so I'm going to give him food, but there's a plan to how do I make him not dependent on me needing him food. Well, he may not be able to be ready to just go do this, so I've got to, how do I help him provide for himself? Does that make sense? Development interventions follow and overlap relief and rehabilitation phases. This is long term. It seeks to improve the standard of living of a population over many years or decades. Poverty didn't get them there today, and we're not going to microwave the solution. And the church has to be committed to long-term efforts. Two big mistakes. One of the biggest mistakes that North American churches make is applying relief in situations where rehabilitation or development is the appropriate intervention. If I just keep giving you bags of groceries, but do nothing to increase your capacity, I'm not helping you. I'm making you dependent. It's what drug dealers do all the time. I'll get you something, get you addicted, and then I'll have a customer for life. And it makes us feel really good, doesn't it? Let's be honest. This is very seductive for us because people need me then. And I like that. I like feeling needed. And that's a perversion of compassion. Second mistake is not understanding those being served. Treating those in generational poverty the same as those in situational poverty. Not understanding the difference can mean we misapply a strategy or skip a step. The fatalism of generational poverty must be broken before betterment or empowerment can occur. I think of a couple. They came to Shepherd, and we were doing really well, and we were a week away from him graduating from a chef school. A week away. We had worked with him for 2 years. He'd been sober for about 5 months. And you know what happened the week before? He got drunk and got kicked out of the program. Why? Because he didn't believe he could handle success. He didn't believe he deserved it. I'm going to tell you, there are many folks that we engage with who do this self-destructive work all the time. And let's go back to John 4. Yes, I know all of that, but I still love you. We see this trap they get into, and they buy the words of the deceiver who say you deserve nothing better. And we have to continue with this model of and message, you are the child of the King. He loves you. And Easter is this tremendous story of the love of the Heavenly Father to the broken folks. So we move beyond food pantry. So TabPres there in Indianapolis, a long-term Presbyterian church. And so they started with this idea, we've got to serve our neighborhood. So they have, you know what a stable door is? you have them in nurseries a lot of times where there's a half.
Yeah.
And so they decided, we're going to serve the poor. So they would open the top half, and folks from the neighborhood could come, and they would hand soup out to them. And we feel really good about that, right?
Yeah.
Look, you know, we gave out 500 cups of soup this week. Aren't we good? And then all of a sudden, someone said, Pastor, maybe we should eat with the folks. And so they opened both parts of the door and set up tables and chairs, and then people came and eat with them. It's a novel concept, isn't it? But let's, this last part, then all of a sudden they said, you know what would be really cool? What if we helped our neighbors start a restaurant called the Unleavened Cafe? And the grandma, Miss Mary, who, not Mary, Miss, I don't know, she hugs everyone who comes in. So now, the neighbors of that church own this restaurant. And the neighbors can go, and guess what? They eat great food. I don't know that it's healthy, but it's good. It's really good.
Yeah.
They can eat whenever they want. And if you come in there and you can't afford to pay, she doesn't care. She'll take care of it. And now neighbors get employed to help work in the restaurant. A long way from that stable door, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of the things that we're trying to get away from even at Shepherd is our food pantry. And we're going to a food co-op. And folks pay $2 a week to get about $50 worth of food. And you would not know it if you came to Shepherd, but on the side we have built a chicken coop. I hate chickens. They're mean. I just yell nuggets at them. And they probably don't like me either. You go out there with a dipping sauce. If it's your day to work in the chicken coop, you clean it up, you feed the chickens, and you take all the eggs they get. And so we have different families take each day. And they get 8 to 12 eggs. We have 20, we started with 25, we're down to 22 families who are doing this. And we want to grow that. We want to help them help themselves. But we can't stop there, and so we have a greenhouse, and we're creating spots in our property. And here's something, even as I looked around here, this was probably a farm at some point in time before it became Church Lane. And what if the idea was grow, not mow? What if our churches said, we're going to take in some of our property and we're going to create plots of land? And we're going to say to our neighbors, if you would like a plot to grow, we've got these seedlings and we'll help you plant. And on Tuesday nights, everyone will come together and we'll work together in each other's plot to take care of it. Now, growing up, my dad loved gardens. And what my dad loved, I hated. You know, that garden that became like a 100-acre forest, I think, when I had to weed it, produced a lot of food. And I learned some things, like if you want to weed in July, it's good to get up early. Not wait till noon, not a good time. But what if we said to these neighbors, not that we're going to give you a free plot, or not that we're going to grow the food and give it to you, but if you'd like, you can have a plot. And on Tuesday night, we'll bring out a watering can, and we'll water everyone's garden. And it's not that you work yours, and you work yours, and you work yours, but it's, we'll go and work with each other. And so we have church members working with neighborhood folks, and we're growing food. And in some years, it seems as if God has a sense of humor, and he sends enough tomatoes to feed everyone in the world 10 times.
Yeah.
And so what if we start sharing things? Is this a concept that maybe means that we're living life together? Maybe it's community. Maybe it's discipleship with a hope. It's a way for us to begin to make connections and empower folks to provide for themselves, not just be handed you another basket. Saws, this is a group that builds, it's two other churches, and they came together. I don't know how, because it's a Presbyterian church and a Methodist church, and so we're sort of the referees there for these two churches. And then, you know, they yell Calvin, Wesley, back and forth. So what they would do is they would come in and they would say, we'll build the ramp for the for whoever needs it. And so one of the young mothers in our program had been hit by a drunk driver and she lost her legs, and so they were helping build this for him. And so they would do everything for him, and we said, you really shouldn't do that, because that person that you're building the ramp for should have a part to play. And we said, why don't you let them fix you lunch? And they're like, oh no, we can't have fixed lunch. And why would, I feel so bad. Oh, I feel sorry for them, right? And instead, what they now say is, okay, you're responsible for lunch for our crew, and we'll have 10 folks out there, and it's going to take 2 days, so we need you to fix lunch for 2 days. And guess what the people said? Great.
Yeah.
Because we just said to you, you have something to give. And if you are a creation of the great God of the universe, he didn't make a mistake with you. But he blessed you with something. And so now they help fix the food and serve it to the guys, even if they're in a wheelchair. So let me talk to you about our Christmas story. We would have this Christmas program, and kids would come, and they would jump up on Santa's lap, and he'd give them a gift, and we were sitting there going, oh, I feel so good. Look at these kids. They're so happy, and the parents are going. And it became personal. My wife's brother, his name's Mark, he didn't get married till later in life, but when our kids were young, he would buy them a ton of gifts. Jeremy and Jenna and Jill loved Christmas with Mark. And he would buy them like 15 or 20 gifts. Yeah. Now, I would tell him two things. One, buy me something. But two, don't outdo me. I'm the dad. Because I really didn't look forward to Christmas with Mark. Because my kids were never without, but I wasn't buying them 15 or 20 gifts. I didn't have the ability to do that. But yet, every year at Christmas, Shepherd Community did the same thing to our neighbors. Mm. So we move forward to today, and what happens each year at Christmas is we have a store. And the parents pay a little bit of money, and they get to come shop and get all these gifts for their kids, all new. Hats, gloves, socks, underwear. We have the pink room, the Barbie room. It is every Barbie known to mankind. And so this last year we did about 2,000 kids would have gotten gifts. But the kids never know that we're part of it. Because the parents show up. The grandma shows up, whoever they're living with shows up, and they're taken through with a volunteer. And we generally try to make sure it's a volunteer who's part of our local church. And so I'm taking this bag with you, and we're picking out new toys, hats, gloves, socks, underwear. The kids are really excited about the socks and underwear. They just look forward to that gift. And so they're going to end up with about $75, $80 worth of gifts for each of their kids. And they pay something like $2 each. And so they're going through. And then at the end, we have volunteers there to help them wrap the gifts. I mean, gift bags were made for me. I have no idea how to make it even out. It's like, if I can just get it shut and some duct tape, it's fine. Yeah. But then at the end, you know what they write? They write, from mom or dad.
Yeah.
Or from grandma. Not from Shepherd Community. Or and so what do you think the parents leave feeling? I've just provided for my kids.
Yeah.
That's an empowering way. But we also then have a church member who's shopping with you and says, hey, if you don't have a church, we'd love to have you come.
Yeah.
Now, which time do you think they're more interested in being in community?
Yeah.
When I've just given your kid all this stuff and I'm feeling good and you're feeling humiliated?
Wow.
Or when you just felt empowered to touch them?
Yeah.
To be able to minister to your own kids. Root causes of person's problems and ask, how could the church help these people address the root causes? Ask whether the need of the participant may offer a bridge to other dimensions of ministry to address the spiritual, physical, educational, relational, emotional, or economic needs. Jesus did this consistently. There's a paralyzed guy next to the pool, and he uses that as an opportunity to bridge into the spiritual needs. This lady who needed community, who felt rejected by society, he used that to move into her spiritual needs and then into a community transformation.
Yeah.
They're all about connections. This one is a really important thing, and I'm going to read it exactly because I think it's one of the most important slides. Give once and you elicit appreciation. Give twice and you create anticipation. Give three times and you create expectation. Give four times and it becomes entitlement. Give five times and you've established dependency. What does welfare do? Yeah. A year ago, or this past April, my wife and I and my daughter were in Eastern Kentucky with one of our generals, Dr. J.K. Warwick. And we stood on the porch. How many of you have ever seen the photo of Lyndon Johnson declaring the war on poverty? He stood on a porch in Turkey Creek, Kentucky, with Tom Fletcher and Tom Fletcher's kids. In 50 years to the week, we stood on that same porch. And if you Google Martin County, Kentucky, you'll see a picture of this today that my daughter took. And there we are with a couple of the pastors, with the then district superintendent, and Dr. Warwick and myself. And we're talking to Tom Fletcher's son, Calvin. And we're standing on the same porch, and there's still no running water, and there's still no electricity. And he says, you know, government promised us a lot. Could the church do something? They've had radical transformation. They went from the worst county in America to the fourth worst. Huge progress in 50 years, don't you think? Because government isn't the answer. The church is. Here's some of the rehab programs: ESL, job training, financial literacy, GED. What about this concept? What if you said, if you want food from us, you need to go through a budgeting class? And our neighbors would say, but I don't have enough money. So what am I going to budget? What if instead we said, we're offering a budgeting class for our whole church? Would you go with me? It's not for you, it's for us. And so if Pastor Kyle's who I'm working with, and I say, hey, Kyle, you and your wife want to go with Jane and I? We're going to go to this class on money management, and I know I could use it. And then afterwards, we go to McDonald's for coffee, and Kyle said, gee, I didn't understand this. Because in poverty, Kyle's not going to go, what's a debit? What's a credit?
Yeah.
Right? He's not empowered to do that. But in relationship, we can do it. So what if we did ministry together? Mm-hmm. It's ministry with, not ministry to. Mm. Development initiatives include affordable housing, entrepreneurship, healthcare innovations, alternatives to payday lending.
Oh, man.
Hate those things. IDA. John McKnight, a researcher out of Northwest University, has this asset-based approaches to poverty alleviation. What's right with you? So we just started a thing called the Shalom Project there at Shepherd Community. We've taken a very narrow part of our neighborhood that surrounds us, 15,000 folks in less than a mile square around our church and our ministry. So if you just factor into this, we're feeling really good at 350, but there's 15,000 folks within, even in as bad a golfer as I am, I could hit a golf ball farther than the boundaries of this. So we have a long way to go, right?
Yeah, sure. Yep.
So we haven't really achieved it very well. But we just started doing surveys in the neighborhood, and we asked this question, what's good happening? We're hearing some interesting things. We're used to going, what do you think of the problem? What do you need? What if we said, what do you have to give? That's recognizing in them how their Father in heaven sees them. For I know the plans I have for you. What resources are already here? We think the idea is, let's go find the resources and bring them. What if it's building on what's there and hearing from our neighbors? There's a church in Indianapolis that has a roving listener, neighborhood listener, and that's what he does. He goes around the neighborhood and listens to people. When you go into homeless camps, we go into homeless camps each week, and some of our staff does, and volunteers and members of our church. And here's the number one thing they'll tell you when you go into the camp. Don't bring me anything. I don't need anything. Don't dump a bunch of trash on us and feel good about it. Would you just come and listen to me? I want to be heard.
Yeah.
Desire a relationship. I've got all the stuff I need. I just want you to need a friend. So what if we begin to hear and say, what is it that's already here that we can build on? The four elements of ABCD, the asset-based community development. Identify and mobilize the capabilities, skills, and resources that are in the community. Look for resources and solutions to come from within the individual or community, not from outside. Seek to build and rebuild the relationships among local individuals, associations, churches, businesses, school, and government. And only bring in outside resources when it is asked for and local resources are insufficient to solve the pressing needs. Sometimes in disasters, we'll fill up a box truck and send it full of supplies when it might have been more effective to buy stuff there locally, right? Mm-hmm. Helps the local businesses, mm-hmm. helps them recover too. The oaks of righteousness, the spirit of the sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them not welfare but a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a replanting of the Lord, for the display of his splendor. They will rebuild the ancient ruins and restore the places long devastated. They will renew the ruined cities that have been devastated for generations. The way we minister to the poor has got to be different than the world. And this session that we've just gone through. So let me talk to you in some examples. Food. We all like it, right?
Oh, yeah.
So if you're in my neighborhood and you go to Miss Mary's house and she'll feed me and then she'll say, did you get enough? Did you get enough? It's why buffets are in my neighborhood. It's not. Cece's Pizza exists.
Yeah.
Not because of what it produces, but you can get plenty of it.
Yeah.
If it's a middle-class America and we go over to a friend's house after they're done, they'll go, how was it? Different question, isn't it? Did you get enough? How was it? And if you have a privilege and someone takes you to one of those really expensive restaurants and they bring you food, what's the question? That's if you're paid.
Yeah.
They'll come up and they'll go, how's it look?
Yeah.
And I say, doesn't look like much.
Yeah.
That looks like an appetizer.
Yeah.
Did you get enough?
How was it?
How does it look? Mm. It's all food, but it's a dramatically different mindset. Mm. Let's talk about money. When the tornadoes went through southern Indiana a few years ago, an area called Henryville, our church responded and we said we need bottled water because we're sending teams down. And we were calling out the families of the parents of kids in our program saying, you got to go with us, and we're taking teams down and work each day. And there was a lady, her name's Trudy. And Trudy had this, you ever heard of a car called a hoopty? Yep, this is Trudy's car. Duct tape, wire, I think everything was holding that car together. And she shows up at church, and her car is full. Every open spot was full of bottled water. Because money is to be used. And someone had a need, so Trudy went and spent all her money on bottled water. Now, next week, Trudy had a problem. She had to pay rent. Trudy didn't think about next week, because right now, there was a need and she needed to respond. Because money is something to be used. Middle class America, we're trained to do what with money?
Save it.
Save it. Those who are very wealthy are to invest it. It's all money, but a much different perspective on that. We've been working with our local hospital, and God's doing some amazing things, and it looks like they're going to build a clinic with us there to serve our neighbors. One of the biggest problems they have is people miss appointments. Why do those in poverty miss their doctor's appointments?
Transportation.
Why would you go to the doctor if you're not sick?
Yeah.
Now, if I'm sick, I go, but why would I go otherwise? Now, how many of you plan out your doctor's appointments ahead of time? Well, checkups? Why would you do that? Why do I go to the dentist on Monday to have a cleaning and let some guy who I like, but I don't like him sticking his hands in my mouth if my tooth isn't hurting? And then you go to the wealthy where they pay a doctor to be on call 24 hours a day to have access anytime. It's all health care, but we view it differently. You know, one of the issues and challenges we have sometimes in third world areas, but we've sure had this issue down in Appalachia, as your church is responding in exciting ways and wrestling with this issue of Appalachian poverty and the church's response to it. If I went up to you and said, I'm here to renovate your home, see, there's nothing wrong with my home.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you go, the back end falling off. There's a hole in your kitchen floor and I can see the dirt. My home's fine. Mm-hmm. And so at times we begin to diagnose for others what it is. And there was one that I had to learn to deal with our Hispanic neighbors. And it's this. Why do you need a refrigerator? Our culture demands it, right?
Yeah.
Matter of fact, in Indiana, if they were to come into your home, if Children's Services was, and you don't have a refrigerator, they'll take the kids. But our neighbors, our Hispanic neighbors, don't know why you need a refrigerator.
Yeah.
Because culturally, what do you do every day?
Yeah.
You go to the bodega, and you buy what you need that day. Why would you store stuff up? It's a mindset difference. And so my whole point in this is that many times you and I look at situations and we think that we know what's best. But it's based on our own upbringing. It's based on our... I mean, you all think that the Cardinals are the best team. That's based on where you live. Get out of here.
We'll race.
These things that we think make sense don't always make sense for others. And so we can't presuppose that. Does that make sense? Okay, so here's what I want to transition into is the last phase. So the question, do we want to take another break or do we want to keep going? Okay, we're going to keep going.